Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage from Augmented World Expo 2026 and looking at the broader open and droppable things that give me some hope for where things might be headed here in the future. So today's episode is with Amanda Watson, who has been a really incredible XR engineer over the years, who worked at Oculus on the Quest, on Oculus Link, on Oculus Air. She also recently worked at a robotics company, and so we talk a bit about her vision of the intersection between XR and robotics and teleoperation. Really quite interesting. But she also did this emulator called Citra VR, which is Nintendo 3DS emulator, so able to recreate the kind of stereoscopy that is already being included within these 2D games, but to actually do it within the VR itself. And the big innovation there, I think, is that it's one of the first GPL-compatible XR apps that are out there, meaning that she didn't use the Meta SDK at all. She basically rewrote all the different core functions that you need to be able to be compatible with the GPL copyleft license. And so that's really quite amazing that she created the very first app that was compatible with GPL, which for GPL, one of the things with copyleft is that you have to have everything that's included be also open and interoperable. And so because there were like different aspects of things that were proprietary, like the Meta SDK, it was never really possible to be compatible with the GPL. But she created the whole stack that needed to operate for this kind of immersive experience. So later this year, SteamFrame is coming out with Arch Linux, which is going to be an operating system, which is based upon the GPL. There's a lot of different discussions around the different open source licenses. MIT is what most people prefer because you can do whatever you want with it. But the big important thing around GPL is that if you think about from the perspective of the user, it means that you have democratized access to the code that was used to create that, which means that you yourself can basically change it. MIT is basically like it lets other big tech corporations or whatever entities use whatever they want, but they don't have any obligation to share it back, which means that they can put it in the context of their proprietary application, and there's no way for you to get access to that code. And so there's kind of like a philosophical difference between the copyleft GPL versus like these MIT licenses. And so it's really great to hear that from Amanda, just because she's also talking about how the state of XR right now has a lot of people that are basically getting fired. And so there's a bunch of this code that is basically going to die on the vine because it's never been released. And there's so much knowledge that's encoded within that that isn't shared back. And so she's really advocating for GPL code in a way of preserving the knowledge around how VR can work at its most optimal way of all these different tricks that have been developed over the years. And so OpenXR is definitely doing that, but also there's different aspects of things like Citra VR and creating her own integration of that. So we cover all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Amanda happened on Thursday, June 18th, 2026 at the Augmented World Expo in Long Beach, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Hey, my name is Amanda Watson. I consider myself a VR software engineer. I've been working in the space since about 2015-ish, working on stuff like the Oculus Quest, Oculus Link, Oculus Air Link, and most recently started doing teleop for robotics.
Nice. So maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into this space.
Yeah, well, I got recruited for Oculus right out of college. I heard about it. I was super obsessed with it. I did everything to try to get a job there. I like impersonated a recruiter from Oculus at my university and got in a lot of trouble for it. But it worked out somehow, and I managed to get the job of my dreams. The only thing is that I had to move to Dallas, Texas. And interestingly there, they didn't have me working on the Rift. They had me working on something called the Samsung Gear VR, which set me on the path to learning a lot about the internals of what would become mobile VR.
Wait, were you working with John Carmack there?
Yeah, he was essentially John Carmack was essentially the boss of the office, I would say. It wasn't really anyone's manager in title, but he would set the direction of the office.
Nice. And so maybe you could talk a bit about your first encounter with VR and what really captured your imagination about it.
I can talk about two things. So the first experience I ever had of VR was when I was 13, I got to go to NASA's VR lab. And I got to try their headset with a data glove. And I thought that was so neat and interesting. And I was immersed. It was cool. And then I never saw anything like that ever again. Just some, you know, crazy space stuff. Then my next experience was trying the DK1 at a hackerspace. And I was still in college at the time. It was like a roller coaster sim. And at the time I was in college just trying to figure out what to do. I was a computer science and drama major. And my advisors were always like, you know, like, what are you going to do with that? Like, you know, you got to figure out something, some application for it. And additionally, not only that, my interest in computer science was not art related. It was operating systems. And they were like, you know, definitely we don't know what you're going to do with operating systems and high performance GPUs. So when I saw the DK1 and I heard about that and I saw how compelling it was, my first thought was, oh, this could retroactively justify everything I've done. I have to figure out a way to work on this. I haven't been so excited about anything in my entire life. If I don't work on this, my life will be so much more boring than it ever could have been.
Nice. And I'm curious, throughout your career since you started in VR, how has the drama aspect kind of woven through what you've done?
I think drama has actually come in a couple of different ways, and it might be surprising. For one, I was a directing major, and I had done a lot of theater before I had gone to college. And a lot of your thinking as a director is thinking about how to stage things such that everybody can see an interesting perspective. You're thinking about sight lines, you're thinking about layering the scene and making sure that nobody has a bad view of it. There's no cinematography, not really. Also, a sleight of hand for transitions. Those sorts of things not only play into like VR storytelling, they also often play into things as simple as like designing the system for VR. When you have a user interface, for instance, you've got to think about, am I going to try to constrain it to this one view? Well, what the user like turns their head? Am I going to make that an uncomfortable view, or am I going to figure out a way to still make it make sense? And so having those kind of spatial concepts, going back to theater for those sorts of things in particular.
Okay. And so being at Oculus, you worked on the Gear VR, and then you worked on a whole slew of really interesting projects. And so maybe you could just kind of talk about a little bit of your evolution of different stuff that you worked on at Oculus, because you were kind of the catalyst for a lot of these like really core important technologies to be able to tie together a PC to tether it through Oculus Link and then Air Link. And so, yeah, just curious to hear, like, from Gear VR, then what else did you work on at Oculus?
Yeah, I started at Oculus working on Gear VR and specifically the runtime. And from there, once I saw the Santa Cruz prototype, I absolutely knew I wanted to work on that next. It was a very considered kind of a risky project. It wasn't clear if that was going to be the next evolution or if it was just going to be a failed demo. But I was very interested because I had a demo and absolutely saw the potential and wanted to, you know, build the best standalone system I possibly could. So I got on that project pretty early. Since I had been working on Gear VR, I was able to leverage a lot of my current knowledge of mobile VR to bring it to standalone. And, you know, that was a nice time, just like building new things. And then I think for the rest of my career, I was just kind of like angry about things not happening as quickly as I wanted them to be or as rationally as I wanted them to be. And those sorts of things were the catalyst for the products like Oculus Link, which was the tether between PC and a standalone headset to access your PC library on a Quest, and Air Link, which is the wireless equivalent.
What were some of the engineering challenges of each of those projects?
Yeah, so one thing I've talked about is an engineering challenge for Oculus Link. We never knew. So at the time, it was known that you needed a very low amount of latency to have a comfortable VR experience. What we didn't know at the time is, one, how good, it's a little technical, but how good extrapolation is, and essentially how much we could push the envelope using modern methods latency before people started getting sick. And that meant that when we were building the Oculus Link pipeline, every time we encounter a bug, the first thing we think to ourselves is, oh, we're having this nauseating experience because of sim sickness, because of the motion photon delay is too big. We totally pushed the envelope. You know, this 30 milliseconds of latency, way too long. And then we would find out it was a bug. there was an example that I gave while I was an employee there, that we had this controller bug. And the controller, when there was a bug where when you tried to wave the controller around, it was kind of like a rubber chicken. It was jello. And we had this whole, the moment we saw it, we had this whole line of reasoning for, oh, that's because we've hit like this fundamental ceiling of too much latency. And of course our software would respond that way if there's too much latency in the system. Now, it turned out after a lot of digging, like weeks of digging, it was just a really complicated math bug. And what that taught me is that we often give up very quickly on these systems and assume there's like a fundamental limit and like go out and get new hardware or try to wait 10 years. But a lot of these things are just bugs in software and we just need to fix them.
How did you find the math error?
Oh, that's a really long story. But it took an extremely long amount of time.
Wow. Okay. So I know that you also, at some point, you left Oculus, but are there any other big projects that you worked on before you ended up leaving Oculus?
Yeah, so I was the creator of Oculus Airlink. That was a project that I spearheaded kind of out of nothing. The context was like the conventional wisdom of VR at the time was, you know, there existed no such thing as a low latency, comfortable, reliable, wireless VR experience powered by PC, and especially not with home routers. My experience with Link had been that often when we think those sorts of things, it is not a fundamental problem. It is probably just bugs that people did not spend a lot of time trying to figure out. And so I felt very compelled at that moment to sit down for many hours and just try to find and fix all of the bugs that had led to that conclusion. But for three different reasons. If we had come to that conclusion that, oh no, we can never have a non-tightly coupled connection between the VR headset, like a display, and something that's rendering, there are huge implications for it. We can't have all sorts of hybrid systems and certainly not affordable ones. It was really important to me that we know whether that was a fundamental issue or whether the software engineers just needed to debug more.
What was it about the types of experiences on the PC that were catalyzing you to want to work on technologies like the Link and Airlink?
I think one of the big reasons that I wanted to work on PC is because that was the community that gotten, the PC VR community is what had gotten me excited about VR in the first place. The catalog of apps, the developers there at the time, especially felt very unwilling to see that disappear with the rise of standalone VR. I wanted people to still have those experiences and see those experiences and have them be a first-class citizen.
And so is there anything else that you worked on before you left Oculus?
I don't know if there's like anything you want to hear about.
Okay. Well, at what point did you decide to leave Oculus and go off on your own? And then what happened?
Yeah. So I decided to leave a lot longer before I actually did. And the long and the short of it is I had started to notice that Airlink and Link were, you know, really needed some stability work. There were, you know, a lot of issues coming in and a lot of people loved the product, but, you know, found it a little unreliable and we weren't addressing it as quickly as I might like. The long and short of it is I kind of had two choices at the time. I could either accept the consensus understanding of how important those bugs were and whether they existed, or I could like, kind of go on a really long solo mission to just fix the bugs that I knew existed and leave at the end of it. And that's what I said I was going to do, and I did it.
Oh, amazing. Thank you. Thank you for that work, because, you know, after using it for a number of years, it's good to have, like, those good connections. So you also worked on, like, an emulator project. Maybe you could talk a bit about that.
So after I left Oculus, Facebook, Meta, I created a project called Citra VR. It's a fork of the Citra emulator, which is a emulator for 3DS. It runs on PC. It runs on Android. One nice thing about the 3DS is it has stereoscopy. You can view it in 3D. And so what mine did differently is it ran on the Quest at a VR interface. And because Quest has two holes for your eyes, you could actually see your 3DS games in true 3D.
Amazing. And so what's going on with that project now? Is it still around?
Yeah, it actually is still around. I tend to not work on it while I'm employed somewhere, so sometimes it gets some spotty stuff, but I try to fix issues when they're brought up. There's still a really active community, and they're wonderful. One other thing I guess I should mention about Citro VR is one of the reasons that it existed in the first place wasn't just to have an emulator. There's been a long-standing issue since the inception of the Rift that because of the way the loader in VR works, you cannot have GPL projects in VR, basically. This is like a long-standing thing. If you go to like the new website, they say that like, you know, Oculus products, Rift products are not permitted. And this has a bunch of problems. It means that certain developers have never developed for VR that otherwise would want to, that were excited about the community before. And there are certain projects that could never be ported to VR, especially emulators, which are often licensed with GPL, free, some, you know, copyleft free software. And so what Citro VR did is it was one of the first fully GPL compliant VR applications. And that also meant that the source code was fully available. So everybody else that wanted to have a GPL compliant application could copy what I did as well.
Amazing. Yeah. The open source is a huge thing that Richard Stallman in February of 1989, creating the first version of GPL and Revolution OS, kind of showing the whole evolution of how the whole internet was powered by open source. And so what did you do in order to make that happen? You usually have to distribute the code when it's launched. And so I guess you couldn't be launched on the store because they obviously are not doing that. So is it like a side loaded? Maybe just describe what do you have to do to be compliant with GPL and do open source development for something like the Quest?
So essentially, to be compliant with GPL, you've got to make every piece of source code that's in your binary fully available open source. You can't have anything that's opaque. And what that means for Citro VR and applications like it is I had to write every piece of code from scratch. That means no Unity, have to write my own engine code, my own 3D math code, and inaccessible library. And then the biggest thing is the VR loader. Now, I didn't do a lot of the reason this happened in 2024 is not because of me. The main reason it happened is because of the work that platform developers were doing, including at Meta, to make the Quest OpenXR compliant. The OpenXR loader is GPL v3 compliant, but Meta had not yet released any support for it. And as far as developers knew, it wasn't possible. Thankfully, if you did a couple of tricky things with the OpenXR loader, you could run it on the Quest. And so the combination of the sort of very alpha support for a open source loader on the Quest platform and the hacks I did to make it work are what made that possible.
Yeah, I'm super excited about the Steam Frame and Arch Linux coming out here. It's going to be the first time that there's a fully GPL operating system on any sort of VR headset. So I'm just curious, like, what was your first encounter with open source GPL and why do you think it's important to do that?
I think open source is important for several reasons. One, it's an important way for people to understand how code works. A lot of the knowledge for how to create VR is not written down and very opaque to people. VR is very difficult. It's less about getting the motion to photon latency down and more of applying very specific tricks very precisely to make sure that latency is hidden. Many of those tricks are generally just not known to people that haven't worked on VR platforms before. If you're new and entering the industry and you have not worked with people that have worked in VR before, you may not be able to go read a book and find out how to make a VR headset or make VR work in a way that feels smooth. So I think it's sad that we don't have more open source examples. Now we're getting more. You know, Monado is a great example of something that's open source that people can now look at as a VR runtime. And so the more people do that, the more competitors we can have, the more alternatives we can have, the more people that we can have that are able to customize their VR experience to exactly what they want and show us how to do it correctly.
Have you seen the film Revolution OS?
No.
So it's a documentary came out in 2000. It sort of documents the first 10 years of the internet, and it features folks like Richard Stallman, which for him, he would say free software. And so there's a free and open source, but it sort of features a lot of the main people who were coming up with the Cathedral of the Bizarre and other folks who were basically at the front lines of the 1999 when the first companies were going public that were run on Linux. And so, but they cover the first decade of the internet and how so much of it was run in open source. And so I feel like we're kind of in a similar moment right now where we kind of have like the internet with all those open standards and open source was what made it so amazing. I feel like XR has been in all these walled gardens that it feels like this inflection point of sorts with more and more momentum that I hear people talking about the importance of open source and especially GPL code, because a lot of people who use open source want MIT license, but the MIT doesn't force people to distribute the code. So anybody can grab it and use it. And there's a lot of a kind of extractive nature of big companies swapping up stuff, but no obligation to contribute back. And so I feel like the GPL is going to, in some ways, create an obligation to make this code more accessible for people to change it and to have more agency and autonomy over it. So I'm super excited and also excited around the Steam Frame and having the first headset that's going to actually be based on like a Linux distribution. So curious to hear any of your thoughts on any of that.
Yeah, you know, GPL is so funny. You have such a different opinion about it depending on which side of it you're on. Some people really love GPL. They love to see GPL code, or they'll curse the ground if they see a library they want to use and realize, oh, it's GPL. My code will be GPL too if I end up using it. But I guess I'd like to offer the perspective that, you know, were it not for open source right now, a lot of VR knowledge and VR software would be dying right now. Realistically, it's a lot of people getting laid off. There's a lot of projects that are shutting down. There's a lot of code that was written by very passionate, very smart people over about a decade that will never see the light of day. If we didn't have open source and those people writing code that's accessible, we would never be able to use that code again.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff that's shutting down, so... Yeah, well, is there anything else before you worked on robotics that you did after the emulation that you think is worth mentioning?
Just that I just had a desire to work with autonomy and work independently after that point. I did a lot of just independent consulting for different small companies, generally ones that wanted something to do with, you know, wireless VR or wireless media streaming, that started with a lot of smaller VR companies. But then I started to see clients that wanted robotics and robot teleop. And slowly but surely, I started getting enmeshed in robotics.
So maybe help tell the story of how are XR and robotics connected? Like, as someone who's coming from the XR VR industry, where's the intersection points for what's happening in robotics and what is the XR angle?
Yeah, I think people overblow it sometimes just because robotics is so popular. It's good to be realistic. I think the main intersection, which is quite important, is that VR headsets are one of the most accurate and desirable interfaces for humans controlling robots. And it's because it maps extremely well to people and it's good for retargeting. There is not really another interface if they want to have a human be one-to-one with a robot, not necessarily a humanoid robot, just any robot with arms and a head that really compares to a VR headset. Additionally, beyond just wanting your robot to be motion accurate to a human, you also often want it to be low latency and high fidelity. What I have found is that VR developers know a lot of tricks for doing that that roboticists currently don't. A really good example of this is WebRTC. WebRTC is seen as like this wonderful discovery in robotics right now. It's like this wonderful way to get really low latency teleop. But a VR developer knows that that is way too high latency and because it adds another 100 milliseconds. So there's a lot of opportunity for VR developers to go into the robotics industry and prove that you can actually do streaming in under 100 milliseconds by doing something else.
What are some of the biggest lessons that you learned after working at a robotics company?
I think it's important to be honest about your capabilities. I think that VR, crypto, robotics have all undergone some kind of bubble. And a recurring theme that I've seen is that people will state things about the technology as if they're true right now, but it's actually something that they hope to be true by the time somebody actually, their products get into the hands of users. And I think that does a couple of things. One, it creates a distortion that never gets corrected. It's just the market never lives up to the expectations. And two, it makes it very difficult for companies that are being honest about their capabilities to work and deliver in the space. They constantly feel this pressure to either leapfrog the current capabilities or lie themselves. one thing that's a little frustrating to me in robotics right now is teleop works extremely well. It's extremely accurate. It's actually quite immersive, very present. You can control a robot that's bigger and taller and smarter than you and have it lift boxes and throw things, and it works wonderfully. There are so many companies that are doing exactly that, telling their investors that it is autonomy and, they're having a stated goal of getting rid of that teleop as quickly as possible. Because even though it works extremely well, it's not the thing they want and not the thing they value. And I don't think I would have known about that going in. And I think it's something that people in the industry aren't really talking about because it feels like you're shutting robotics down and you're being unsupportive. But I think it's really important to be honest because, you know, if you're not honest right now, people will miss what you're really good at and be disappointed when it doesn't go the way you promise.
Nice. And it sounds like you're also in a bit of a liminal moment right now. Maybe just share whatever you can in terms of the ending of that phase and then whatever you can say around what's next for you.
Yeah, well, I recently left my last company not too long ago, which was in robotics. I'm really excited about the robotics industry. I think there's a lot of things that are there that are real and good. You're going to see some great things from a subset of the companies. I just got done with AWE. And I'm feeling very reflective. It's one of the quietest versions of AWE that I've seen. I see a lot of people nervous that their vision for VR might not play out the way they want it to. And, you know, Michael Abrash talked about that feeling of presence. This is a feeling of presence right now. I don't know what the future is. I don't really know if the past reflects how I thought the past would go. I only know exactly what's happening right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of endings and new beginnings and a bit of a liminality. And do you have any other thoughts about the wider XR industry? Where, like, what's the story you tell about what's happening right now?
Oh, man. This seems to be a time where a lot of companies are winding down their VR efforts, are reflecting on whether their last VR effort paid off. And there are a lot of companies that are seeking investment in VR that are being told that there is no investment to be had. It's an interesting moment because there's still a lot of people that are hungry in the space and really excited, but they're searching for opportunities and wondering whether there are any. So, you know, this could go a couple of different ways. Maybe, you know, one of the next headsets that gets announced takes off in a way, or maybe one of the existing headsets gets a nice update, a nice app, and everybody figures out exactly what they're supposed to do. Maybe robotics does become big and VR devices become a really good interface for that, and that fuels the VR industry for a while. Or maybe we go into a long VR winter.
Yeah, it kind of feels like that, sort of a end of a cycle, beginning of a new, and the future is pretty much undetermined. Yeah, anything else in terms of what kind of aspirations you have for whatever's next? Like, what do you want to experience or do, or just in terms of aspirations, things that you want to try to continue to work on in your career?
I want to do something real. I don't really like management. I don't really like all this abstract, like figuring out roadmaps or telling people, you know, what the future of a platform is going to be. I definitely want to get my hands dirty and deliver something concrete. I want to help users. I want to make sure that whatever I do next genuinely helps the people it's made for and that people genuinely enjoy it. And I want to not make big, bold bets about what the future will exactly be. I know everything will turn out, but I don't think anybody's got a clue at what exactly it will look like 10 years from now.
Awesome. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of virtual reality might be and what it might be able to enable?
I think the ultimate potential for virtual reality is to be a platform that brings value to people.
Nice. And anything else left unsaid you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
I mean, keep your chin up. Be realistic about the expectations, but, you know, I have hope.
For sure. Yeah, it feels like it's a moment where, despite all the empirical evidence, people still believe in their own embodied experiences of the medium. And so I feel like that's a lot of the themes I'm hearing. So I really appreciate you articulating that. Did you have something else you wanted to say?
Oh, yeah. The other thing I should follow up on is, do pay attention to the evidence, though. I think that's going to be really important for making sure that we have a, you know, accurately successful VR future going forward.
Awesome. Well, Amanda, thanks so much for sharing a little bit of your journey. And you've certainly contributed to some of the most popular projects in XR that are out there, and help to keep the PC VR alive in a way that wouldn't be quite the same industry without that. So thanks again for all your work that you've done. And yeah, looking forward to seeing whatever you do next. So thanks again for joining me here on the podcast. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast and for keeping the faith for where this industry is going here in the future. I feel like this is a kind of a weird time for everybody in the industry. And if you believe in where this technology may go and that it may be able to bring about positive social change and transformation in the world, then please do consider supporting me here at the Voices of VR podcast, trying to navigate these dimensions of transformation and positive change for where all this might be going. So if you enjoy the coverage that I'm doing here, then please do consider becoming a member at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.